You are listening to a podcast of the London Irish Business Society's event in association with Leela, Brexit, In or Out, and What Does It Mean for Ireland? With one of the most important constitutional decisions for Britain fast approaching, there is much debate over whether the UK will exit the EU, and if so, what the impact will be at a European and Irish level. Through thought-provoking discussion, you will hear the panel weigh up the arguments for and against a Brexit and the implications that this will have across Europe and for Ireland in particular. Panelists include Lord Robothan, former Northern Ireland Minister, Dr. Paul Gillespie, former Foreign Policy Editor with the Irish Times, and Brian Kennelly, QC. This event was moderated by Tommy Lyons, Business Editor at the Sunday Business Post, and was hosted at 1 Wimpole Street, London, on May 4th, 2016.
Thank you to Libs and Leela for the invitation tonight. It's exactly 50 days to go until the vote, so I think the timing is certainly opportune. We've got a very distinguished panel here this evening, and I'm just going to start with Paul Gillespie from my right, the former foreign policy editor with the Irish Times, who writes a regular column called World View. He's an academic with UCD and an expert in British-Irish relations. Next, we've got Brian Kennelly, QC. He is a leading advocate, an expert on EU and competition law. He's seen things from the inside. He's been seconded to the legal service of the European Commission. He's worked on competition law. So he's somebody who's seen how the whole system works from the inside and from out. And finally, we have Lord Robothan, who is a Conservative Life peer, and he served as Minister for State in the Northern Ireland office from 2013 to 2014. He's also previously a minister at the Ministry of Defence, and I think he's going to be taking a more contrarian view, maybe, to the typical Irish view, which certainly, as business editor with the Post, the views tend to be the same, that we should stay in. But at the same time, we hear this other conversation, which is around how, you know, Europe insisted during the financial crisis that we bail out all the bondholders and all of those different type of things. So I think that it'll be interesting to hear each person's point of view. And I think that each person is going to initially, they're just going to speak for about 5 minutes and give their key points, and then we're going to go to some questions. If you want to start, Paul, do you want to give your opinion?
Good. Thank you very much. I want to set the scene, the European scene of Irish-British relations, first of all, argue that Brexit would disrupt what's been established there radically and unacceptably, give some details of the book that I have co-edited with Dahi O'Kelly, published by the Institute of International European Affairs in Dublin, and it's online and free download. and there's quite a lot of good material on this subject on that website. And finally, make a couple of provocative remarks about how you campaign for a better Europe critically rather than sceptically, by getting out, critically rather than by staying in. Now, the setting of Irish-British relations in its deep history and in its recent past is a European one. It's to do with empires, with colonisation, with the search for independence, in which Ireland sought allies, even gallant allies, as we know, in Europe, to fight for that independence. And the independence that was established in the 1920s, while formally there and legally there, it still contained a large degree of dependence economically and socially and even culturally on the imperial power next door. John Fitzgerald wrote a very good piece in the Irish Times on Brexit the other day, and he talked about when he judged the Department of Finance in Dublin, he was placing the files dealing with British-Irish economic relations and trade relations, and he said it was like mendicants going to London to search out ways of getting better access to the British market, which dominated the Irish economy. And whereas within months of his joining, the setting was transformed into what his father, Garrett Fitzgerald, former Taoiseach, as you know, referred to in an article in 1975 as a sense of psychological liberation on the Irish side, by which you escape that mendicant status and establish a greater equality of relations between British and Irish elite figures, the political and diplomatic, within this wider European setting. In a way, it's a retrieval from the Irish point of view of that European history. And that transition was to what I would call real independence over the following decades, in which you pooled sovereignty in order to enhance your power as a smaller state, is a very different story to the dominant narrative in the UK. And one has to bear this in mind, not only in terms of the relations, but in terms of the, as it were, competing ideologies of what Europe responds to. And in the last 12 or 15, 20 years, you've had a further transition to what I would call complex interdependence between Britain and Ireland. It's far more amicable, far more normal, transformative in so many ways. And that setting of the Northern Ireland conflict was a big factor in this. The Northern Ireland resolution and argument, diplomatic negotiations between Britain and Ireland on this subject had a European setting. It wasn't causal, but it was enabling. It allowed the political elites, diplomatic and political, to meet in a more respected way and in a way in which trust could grow. Now, that the border opening and the resolution through the Belfast agreements actually coincided, very interestingly, with a lot of the developments of the single markets, the developments in wider European integration. And Ireland and Britain have come to share a lot of values. There's a policy congruence. And they have a lot of ideas of overlap on the shape of Europe, notwithstanding the obvious differences culturally towards the European orientation in terms of identity and also in terms of agriculture or Eurozone or what have you. Now, my argument would be is that a Brexit would radically disrupt this set of relations that have been established, which have a long history as well as a more recent history. The most dramatic way in which this would happen would be that the EU border with the UK would become the Irish border. That would upset the 1998 equilibrium of the Belfast Agreement. The dynamics of the victory that would be claimed by the Brexit groups within the UK would reinforce this. It seems to me that the migration fears would dominate a Brexit victory, not the global free trading dimension. And on the other side, in the Brussels dimension, the contagion fears from a Brexit would reinforce the desire in France and Germany and elsewhere for a very hard-nosed negotiation of the British exit. And that's not a good thing from the Irish point of view. Ireland would be caught in the middle, diplomatically and politically, creating very difficult choices, a difficult search for allies in this question. And I would also fear a return of what I would call the power nexus that determined British-Irish relations before we enter the European community or European Union setting. There'd be a tendency to return to relations of power rather than relations of equality. That's not a good thing either. Brexit would have a disruptive effect on trade, on economic relations, on mobility, on policy congruence, on food and agriculture, on energy markets, all of which is now beginning to emerge in research and media coverage and political debate. Of course, there are some opportunities from the Irish point of view. There would be FTI effects. There would be, in a different kind of way, effects of the what I call, and we call in this book, a dual sovereignty crisis being faced by the UK. It's external vis-a-vis the EU and setting in Europe and in the world. It's internal vis-a-vis the very unity of the United Kingdom because of the Scottish effect mainly. And that changing structure of the UK externally and internally has profound effects on Ireland, which are often underestimated, particularly on Northern Ireland. And you have to think this through. We can discuss this further in debate. But I argue that were Scottish independence to follow a Brexit, the effects on Northern Unionism would be remarkably profound. And you could, in fact, see a real argument about Irish unification developing far sooner than people expect or many people would want to see. And in our book, we discuss what are the optimal outcomes. The UK won't be fully in the EU, including the Eurozone, for the foreseeable future. It could, though, be half in if a pretty decisive result from this referendum. It could be half out, which is a grudging result and a very close one, determined by Celtic fringes or small minorities in the various component parts of the UK. Or, of course, it can be out. And out is ambiguous. It's not unambiguous because it depends on the various models of what out would look like. We explore that in this book. But we don't, and finally, I'll conclude on these points, we take in this book what I would call a critical attitude, not only to Irish-British relations, but to the development of the European Union itself, rather than a sceptical view. You can have a critical view which says you're searching for a better Europe by staying in. We would hope, and we argue in this book, we would hope that Britain and the various forces in Britain who favour remaining in the EU would adopt this course, and that Britain would then be a constructive partner in a search for this better Europe. Europe is facing several, as we all know, overlapping crises, financial and recessionary. The design of the Eurozone, the whole austerity solution or neoliberal solution to these problems, the developing North-South set of problems within Europe, migration, geopolitics, democracy, trust, legitimacy. I mean, these are very big and overlapping now, not just cross-cutting crises. They all need tackling. There are different approaches to this, whether left or right, closer or looser. But I think we should beware the so-called federalist man. We're not on the way to the United States of Europe, even if many of these crises were resolved constructively. We're on the way to what I would call post-sovereign, entangled union, not a United States of Europe, but most, and according to surveys and research that's been done, most citizens of this entity want to see a somewhat closer, more social, more solidaristic kind of union, and are willing to go some of the way towards federal methods to get that. But a federal Europe would involve 30% or 40% of its GDP being concentrated in government, whereas the budget at the moment is 1%. So what I would see as a transition towards some kind of functional federalism in the design of the Eurozone and getting greater transfers within it would be more like 3% or 4% or 5% of the European economy. And I think that's a desirable outcome, and to be radically distinguished from a big federal super state, which is not realistic, not really called for, and it serves only as a rhetorical bogeyman in the argument, particularly in Britain, about the future of Europe, whether it's from Boris Johnson or Michael Gove or others. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Brian, do you want to go next?
Sure. So as Tom said, I've been a barrister practising in the area of EU law. I've had the privilege in that time, especially in the last 3 years, to have represented, among other clients, the UK government in about 20 cases before the Court of Justice of the EU and the General Court of the EU. And in those cases, we have sought to vindicate the interests of this country in the areas in particular of migration, financial services and social benefits. So the areas which are of the greatest political sensitivity, which excite ministers to a far greater degree than other issues. And we have gone and fought for those points with a certain degree of success in the European courts. And in the context of arguing those cases, I have had, again, the privilege, although sometimes it doesn't feel like a privilege, to have negotiated legal positions and the positions of the advocates with the countries which have been allied or at least favourable to the UK's interests, and those which are very much not allied and not favourable to the UK's interests. And patterns appear which may give us insights into how the negotiation will be conducted if the United Kingdom votes to leave in the referendum. But I should make clear that the views that I express tonight are not the views of any of my clients, and in particular not the views of Her Majesty's government. But And one of the difficulties that we have in this debate, and why in some respects it's premature, is that discussing the implications for Ireland will depend on the type that is negotiated after the United Kingdom votes to leave. And there is a very broad spectrum of options available once that negative vote comes in. And one of the oddities of this referendum campaign, if I may say so, is that the Leave campaign are arguing those different options. A bit like Donald Trump's campaign against Ted Cruz, he's attacking, or at least he attacked Cruz, from the left and from the right. One of the geniuses of the Leave campaign is that their different spokespeople, Theresa Villiers, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, are all arguing simultaneously for very different solutions, very different structures, which will arise in the, which will certainly be sought in the event that the United Kingdom votes to leave. And as I said, the effect on Ireland will be determined by which of those options is chosen, and which of those options can be successfully negotiated with the EU. And there are broadly five options, and I think this is a consensus view. The first is the EEA option, which is very close to the current situation. That is what we call the Norwegian model. So effectively, the United Kingdom would have to agree to the free movement of persons. So there would be no effect on migration. But the UK would then have access to the single market, which is of critical importance to, among other things, the financial services industry. The problem of the EEA option, as Norway has seen, is that they don't get to have any say in how EU legislation is developed. But that is the least disruptive model. In my view, perhaps contrary to what Paul just said, is that it might well be possible to maintain the common travel area and the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. But ultimately, if the referendum is won or lost on a very strong anti-migration platform, it's hard to see how the UK negotiators would press for something like the EEA, which would involve no change from the perspective of migration. The next option is called the Swiss option, and some people think this is a possibility. In my view, there is no chance the EU will agree to allow the UK to have the status that Switzerland currently has, not least because the EU is trying to take that status away from Switzerland. It is quite favourable to the Swiss, and the EU gets nothing out of it. So I think that relationship, that structure, is doomed and won't be on the table when the negotiation begins. The next option is the Turkish option, which is a customs union, which will have some benefits to the UK, but critically, no access to the single market. So there will be no free access for goods and services exported from the UK to the EU, but there will be no free movement of persons either, which will address the migration concerns. The fourth option is what is called the bespoke free trade agreement, which is completely uncertain, open-ended dream that the EU will give the negotiators whatever they want. In circumstances where, as Paul said, and as I know from personal experience, there are those within the EU who would do this country harm and who see great advantage in driving a hard bargain when that day comes, an advantage over the UK negotiators. There are broader battles to be fought in that negotiation, and some of our current partners and colleagues look enviously on the status of the City of London and wouldn't be at all sorry if some of that business switched back to places like Paris, which had, of course, been a very great banking centre until the middle of the 20th century. And finally, the WTO option. The idea, which I think Michael Gove has floated from time to time, that it will be sufficient for the UK to rely on the WTO and on the agreements, the bilateral agreements that are agreed in tandem with that. That would involve tariffs being imposed on British goods and services being supplied into the EU, certainly on the basis of the current arrangements, and would cause, in my view, a great deal of harm to the British economy. And all of those options, apart from the EEA option, will have an impact on Ireland. First, the common travel area and the border will definitely be affected. It would be impossible to maintain the current arrangements in a situation where there was no free movement of persons. The common travel area as it is has, in my view, quite a dubious legal standing. It's probably contrary to EU law anyway, but we've managed to get it enshrined in the Treaty on European Union because of the deal that was struck and the importance of the peace process and our combined negotiating power in the Council of Ministers. But that deal won't stick if all that's left is a customs union between the UK and the EU. And obviously, the impact on trade between Ireland and the UK will be detrimentally affected, not least because, in the short term at least, there will be a negative impact on the UK economy. I'm not here to say that in the long term, it will ultimately be to the benefit of the UK, and there are broader interests at stake than just pounds, shillings and pence, but in the short term, there will certainly be negative impacts on the Irish economy. So, ultimately, from a legal perspective, there will be a great deal of confusion and difficulty from the UK perspective and from the Irish perspective if anything other than EEA status is agreed in the event that the UK leaves, in my view.
Thank you, Brian. Lord Rabatten, I've seen you nodding your head. I'm not sure whether it's an agreement.
Not much. I'm going to stand up for various reasons. One is I prefer to stand up, and the second is I have a bad back and needs a bit of exercise from time to time. I feel a bit outnumbered here. I also feel a little outnumbered because I've been told that I'm probably the only Englishman in the room. Is that right?
No.
No, good. But as it happens, I like the Irish, so I'm entirely happy in a room where I've only got one other Englishman. So I'm delighted. I'm also delighted that you're all here, because this is, whatever anybody thinks, this is a really important decision for the people of the United Kingdom. The people have a vote in the referendum. And we should not enter into it lightly. And I'm afraid there is quite a lot of rubbish talked, actually, by both sides about this referendum. Now, the first canard I'd like to shoot, if you shoot a canard, it's dark, isn't it, is that I am not anti-European. I'm self-evidently both culturally and racially European. I like Europe. I even like the French, which is unusual for an English person. I want to cooperate with my neighbours in Europe so that we don't return to war, and that, was, of course, was one of the founding reasons of the EU. I want to trade with my neighbours for their prosperity and for ours. I'm not selfish about this. And I do see some benefits in the EU. The single market, for all its weaknesses, has broadly been a good thing, it seems to me. But I want to leave. And my main reason for wanting to leave the EU is that, for all the talk of economics, the EU is a political construct. It is a dynamic process. It has momentum, and that momentum is towards integration. It's all very well people saying that's not true. It is true, and read the statements of EU leaders. Now, of course, we value our trade with the EU. It's hugely important. But is it the best way that we trade with the EU and the rest of the world the way we do at the moment? I have to say, I think we can do better. Let me quote Stuart Rose, by the way, who was the head of Marks and Sparks, is now the leader of the... Is it called the Better in Europe campaign? I can't remember. Whatever. He didn't know anyway when he was asked. He didn't know what it was called. But he's the chairman of it. And he said that you wouldn't notice any change for 5 years, and after 10 years... you'd only notice a little bit of change. When President Obama came here and made what I thought was a rather ill-judged intervention and said we'd go to the back of the queue for any trade deal with the US, I'm awfully sorry, but we don't have a trade deal with the US. So if we were to leave tomorrow, we'd trade in exactly the same way as we do now with the USA. People say, look, you've got to stay. I've heard it today. We've got to stay. We've got to influence the EU. We've got to reform it. What a great idea. Funny enough, it was first expressed, and I'm older than almost everybody in this room, I fear, apart from you probably, Paul. I remember Macmillan, who tried to get us to join the EU when de Gaulle was the French president, and we refused. Macmillan talked about reform. Every single prime minister of the United Kingdom since Macmillan has talked about, we must reform the EU, of course. It's not going to happen. We have been voted down in the Council of Ministers when we opposed legislation 72 times. So our influence is fantastic. We were voted down 72 times, although we opposed legislation. So we don't have much influence. Now, the reason reform is not possible is because this is a political process. Whilst I value the EU as a trading bloc, that is secondary to the political process, and people on the continent of Europe will tell you that if you ask them. Now, is this political process democratic? Well, if you live here, apparently you don't necessarily have a vote in Ireland. But in 2001, the Irish voted against the Nice Treaty. In 2008, the Irish voted against the Lisbon Treaty, rather more emphatically, because it was 53% turnout. Go away, you little people, and think again. This is not democracy, as I understand, and I guess as you understand. You vote for people, you get them in, you get them out, and we don't do that at the moment. Now, the current situation has been briefly touched on, but I think we should touch on a little bit more. The migrant crisis is not going away. It's shocking, it's ghastly, we all feel for those migrants, but what we've seen in the EU is the Schengen agreement of free movement is collapsing. So Chancellor Merkel is cutting a deal with others, with the Turks, which will allow visa-free access for 75 million Turks into the EU. Now, I'm not sure that that's exactly what the people of Britain or indeed of Ireland want. And actually, she's being blackmailed by Turkey, and I think that's pretty bad. The euro crisis. Well, the euro crisis isn't going away. My own view is that the euro is unlikely to survive in its current form, but I may be wrong, and I try not to make too many predictions. But didn't Ireland suffer, rather, by being in the euro? And that leads me to ask, why on earth would anybody in Ireland want to stay in the euro? So, what is the answer from our EU leaders, our potentates in Brussels? The answer is more Europe. There isn't enough. More integration. And if you don't believe me, please go and Google the Five Presidents' Report, because that will tell you it's all about the answer is closer monetary union. The answer is more integration, deepening monetary union. I don't think that's a sensible answer to what we've got at the moment. My own view is, and you'd expect me to say this, albeit I may be outnumbered, the house in which we are in, the EU, is on fire. Yes, of course we'd like to douse the flames by reforming the EU, but we can't, because we're outnumbered, and the other people don't want to do it. So my answer is leave. Now, other voices will tell you you must stay. Let me tell you some of the voices that tell you you must stay. The OECD, which told Britain in the early 90s it had to join the exchange rate mechanism. People in this room will remember what happened to that. But let's concentrate on the euro, in which Ireland is a part. The CBI said recently that if we didn't join if we left the EU, we'd get something like 1 million people out of work because of it, which is spookily reminiscent of what they said when we debated joining the euro. And guess what? We have the strongest growing economy in Europe. Paddy Ashdown, Peter Mandelson, and a lot of others all got it wrong on the euro, and they're using exactly the same arguments to persuade people why they should vote to remain in the EU. Now, what will the future be? I try not to do predictions, because I'll probably get them wrong. I told you what Stuart Rose said. But actually, nobody knows what will happen if we leave. We heard a little bit from Brian, who was entirely neutral on this. Nobody knows what will happen if we stay. That was also my answer. You tell me what the EU is going to look like in 10 years, with greater integration, with Turkey as a member, with the euro collapsing, whatever. Tell me. Nobody knows. How could you know? We can't see into the future. But I am going to make just one prediction. And that is, if the great British public vote to remain in the EU, in 10 years' time, they will regret having done so. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Robarton.
Robarton.
So the house is on fire and the sensible people are outnumbered. Would you like to respond to that, Paul, around that issue of is this a democracy and the fact and some of the points there about how Britain has been voted down 72 times?
I'm a political scientist. There's a lot of research being done on how influential Britain is. You may be able to formally say it's been voted down 72 times, but that's not the full measure. There have been many thousands of times in which Britain has actually got its way compared to that small number in which it hasn't. Most of the political science research on the subject shows that Britain is very influential because it has a most effective civil service, very focused political engagement and involvement in the EU, where it makes a priority, as all member states have to do. Remember, the single market itself is a British construct coming out of Thatcher, out of the liberalism of her approach. Remember that the issue of reform, the new Junckers Commission, however he was elected, is very much committed to the kinds of reform that Cameron was looking for in terms of less bureaucracy, more subsidiarity, much less legislation. And that's measurable and quantifiable. As to the democratic side, I made that distinction between the sceptical and the critical approach. I would be very critical of the degree of democracy within the system, but I don't bring that criticism to the point of scepticism to say that it's irreformable and therefore we have to get out. I think there's lots of evidence of reforms which have been gradualist, incremental, not radical enough, but actually are there.
Could you name one?
Yes, I would mention that. I would mention that. I would mention the subsidiarity stuff out of this new commission as a good example.
Which we haven't seen the results of yet.
It's rolling along. There's far less legislation than there used to be in the previous commission. So much so that the British government, in its approach to this subject and the studies it did about the levels of competence, had to agree that it was just about right from the British government point of view, and the most exhaustive surveys that they did.
Brian, if I could pick up on one of the points there made about President Obama, who was saying about being put to the back of the queue. Do you think that that's the way things work? Is that something that he's right about, or do you think that it's something that he's wrong about? That Britain would be better trying to negotiate these things one-on-one.
I'm not going to comment on the political wisdom of telling a sovereign people what to do. I know how the Irish would have reacted if they'd been told. but unfortunately, Obama was making a point that was blindingly obvious, in my view, which was that the US, in vindicating its own interests, seeks to do the most useful trade deals first. And it does trade deals with the largest blocks first. Those trade deals are very complex, difficult processes. And so they begin with China, the EU, India. And countries like the UK, for whatever the special relationship is worth, will be at the back of the queue. There is no way the US is going to negotiate a bespoke trade deal with the UK before it has resolved, in particular, the trade deal with the EU. So although he wasn't very polite, what he said was just a statement of the blindingly obvious. But I think that the real issue isn't so much the trade deal with the US, because the US is quite difficult in terms of trade deals. And the trade deal with the US is not the be-all and end-all from the UK perspective. And it's one of the tragedies of this country, in my view, that this obsession with the relationship with the US blinds the UK to the more critical strategic relationships which are open to it, both in Europe and in the Far East. Mm-hmm. The US is not a very friend, for all of the talk of the special relationship, they can be quite a brutal partner. And sometimes the UK, certainly the UK elites, miss that. The real problem for the UK in terms of trade deals is the trade deal with the EU. Roughly 50%, and I know Michael Gove said the figure is falling, 44, but it has fallen from 52 to 44 in the last few years. On any view, a substantial amount of trade is done between the UK and the EU. And that will be seriously affected by the terms of the deal which is struck by the EU and the UK, and that will not be struck in a spirit of goodwill and friendship. As I said earlier, there are people, and you're talking about the reform that has been pushed through the EU by the UK in particular, there are many people within the EU and many leaders of member states who will breathe a sigh of relief if the UK leaves, and they will be involved in negotiations, and it will not be straightforward from the UK's perspective. And then you have China. The Chinese aren't renowned for their great sympathy and charity when it comes to trade deals, and they will not be favourably disposed towards the UK in terms of any specific bilateral deal. It will be a hostile, difficult place for the United Kingdom on its own in negotiating these trade deals. And bizarrely, some of the best friends the UK has in the world are in the EU, and not just the Irish, and we are definitely very good friends with the UK in the EU. But the Dutch and other countries who will be very sad and disappointed and concerned for their own position if the UK leaves. So I think the trade deal with the EU is actually more important, and the trade deals in the Far East. I think the Obama trade deal with the US thing was more party political propaganda, really. But the basic message he was making globally was an accurate one.
And just to ask the panel, I mean, Northern Ireland was mentioned a couple of different times there. It's so easy to trade across the border at the moment. What does the panel
like Brexit, how big an impact is that going to have on trade between the North and the South, which has really been progressing so well since the peace process?
I see absolutely no reason why it should be any different driving from Dublin to Belfast than it is now. Why should it be different? The border, when it was meant to be closed, wasn't very closed, was it? But not in my experience. I mean, not what I heard. And why should trade stop? You know, if it's in the mutual interests of the Irish and the British to trade, the Northern Irish and the British to trade with each other, why should that stop? I mean, this is bizarre. I think if I might say so, Brian has made a good point. that of course we need a deal with the EU. Of course we need a trading deal with the EU, but the EU is largely a rather protectionist organisation, if you ask me. They don't have a trade deal with China, do they?
No.
They don't have a trade deal with India, do they?
There is a bilateral arrangement. It's not right, a full bespoke
trade. And of course they don't have a trade deal with the US. And this TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Programme, is that what it stands for, is struggling after 3 years because people here are very unhappy about a lot of it. And big corporations, and it is generally big corporations and states, are lobbying very hard to get their own way. So I think you have made a good point. Of course we need to deal with the EU. We're only the fifth largest economy in the world. We're not Norway. We're not Switzerland. And it may be that some of our great friends in the EU do indeed, as you said, wish us harm. Well, that's saying a lot for the European Union, to which we are now subjugated. This is bizarre, if you ask me. Would the French, who are actually, I always admired this about the French, they are very, very keen on their own self-interest. And good for them. Some doesn't always coincide with ours, but good for them. But would the French really cut their noses off to spite their face? Is that really how serious governments work? Because we have a huge trade deficit with the EU. Trade overall with the EU is declining as part of our trade, but we have a huge deficit with the EU. And therefore, if the tariff walls were to go up on one side, inevitably tariff walls would go up on this side, and they would be indeed the losers. Now, what I'm saying at this, and I haven't said it before, is we need to take back control. It's not so difficult, is it? Don't we have the confidence, the self-confidence? Don't we have the optimism to say, as the fifth largest economy in the world, we can take back control, we can stay friends with our neighbours, and we can trade with our neighbours, but we don't have to be subjected to what they all think.
And do you think it's, Paul, like that ability to take back control, do you think that that's something that Britain has and that's something that Britain can do?
Well, I you asked about Northern Ireland, and I would agree with Brian that the definitions of the out regime make a great deal of difference to the pattern of trade and relations in Ireland. That's the legal reality. On top of the legal reality, which Brian outlined very clearly, you've got the political dynamic reality, which I touched on, as to the fear in Brussels and in continental Europe of the contagion effect of a Brexit, given all these crises. And I'm making an analytical point rather than an advocacy point here, they would be scared of disintegration. And, of course, they know that the people claiming the victory in a Brexit, they may believe the system is going to get deeper, but actually they would want to see it, many of them, see it disintegrate. So this becomes a relationship of enmity, at least in the transitional period, and it would be a very hard nose and sharp bargaining system in which politics would tend to override the legal and trading relations. That's my reading of it, from a political point of view. And on the other side, the whole question of migration would affect the ways in which Northern Ireland border was defined and seen. And so, actually, again, you'd have a politics overriding the kind of trading interest. And that's the worry about the dynamics of the setting.
And that issue, the migration crisis, I was in Calais 3 weeks ago. You can see it there. It's very real. Does the panel think that, you know, that it would be better for Britain to be part of a solution, a European solution, or is Britain better standing alone and doing its own thing?
Well, if I may answer, yeah. And what is the European solution?
Well, they haven't come up with one.
Well,
thank you.
Well, no, that's not right. On the contrary, the European Union has produced a solution, and because it's a difficult problem, and because we are torn between our selfishness, that is the fact that we don't want to expose our social welfare systems to a bunch of extremely poor and desperate people, the tension between that and our desire not to allow children to drown in the Aegean means the solution will inevitably be messy, and it's just naive to think that it won't be. But there has been a solution reached, and it is a solution which involves discouraging people from making the journey from Turkey to the EU and encouraging the Turks to play their part. And we're paying a very high price to Turkey as part of that deal. But no one came up with a better deal. None of the Brexiteers suggested a different solution. And it's just not possible for individual member states to take action unilaterally in a problem like this. It doesn't work like that. If you lock the doors, they come in through the windows. And that is why a global, certainly a European solution, was the best that could be done at the time. So there has been a package of measures put forward within the EU context, which could only have been negotiated by the EU collectively, and which is addressing a very serious problem. And it's a much more serious problem for the countries facing the Balkans than it will ever be for the UK or Ireland. And I think we have to have a reality check here. You know, we sit here panicking about migration from the East, but the truth is, although many of them would love to come to London and work here, the countries that are in the front line and the second line are the ones who have taken action within the context of the EU and have produced a solution. And if it had involved, for example, allowing visa-free access for tens of millions of Turks, to be honest, tens of millions of Turks already enter the EU in the legitimate programmes that we have through our agreements with Turkey, which have been there for decades. But if more Turks are allowed in under this arrangement in a controlled manner, that's a price well worth paying, and may not be a bad thing for the European economy either, in view of the demographic problems that we face in countries like Germany.
Do you want to come in there, Paul?
Well, I agree with the trend of Brian's remarks. Looking at this issue realistically, we're in a big geopolitical setting with neighbours to the Middle East, to Africa, North Africa, and you have to look at this over a long, over decades, the next couple of decades, and there is huge demographic pressure here. There is political crisis which requires European attention, both politically, diplomatically, but also in terms of development aid, in terms of the spending of money. The money was doubled to Turkey from 3 billion to 6 billion a year. In my view, that's still far too little. This is the scale of this geopolitical crisis in our neighbourhood requires far more expenditure. I would be talking about 50 billions in order to deal with the transfers that would incentivise people to stay where they are, to the politics and diplomacy of helping to resolve the crisis, including the Syrian crisis, that brings them, and thirdly, the effort to bring people in a patterned and controlled way along the lines of the deal that's been done, existing one. Lots of ways this done. You could take out bonds for development bonds and fund them through a collective effort. 30 billion, the 50 billion is still very small amount of money, and which would fund the kind of collective effort required. And if you're dealing with the next generation, and if the price of not taking action is going to encourage greater enmity over that generation, you're foolish not to be much more ambitious than people are about it.
Do you want to come in, Lord?
I'll just come in very briefly. I think Brian has expressed very well, actually, the dichotomy about the refugee crisis. And it's, you know, one could be, I certainly won't be flippant about it. There are people dying probably today trying to get away from the ghastly Syrian civil war. Not all of them, of course, are Syrians, but people are taking their lives in their hands for some reason. And I think we should help them. I think we have a Christian duty to help them, as simple as that. Whether we should encourage them further to come to the EU is another matter. I don't think we should. And actually, the British government has been very good about funding refugee camps in the region. It's not easy. It really isn't easy. So let's not anybody have any trite, simple answers. But I don't think Angela Merkel helped when she said she'd take that, was it 800,000 or a million refugees she'd take take. Because, of course, actually, if you're sitting in Aleppo, you think, well, that means I can go as well. And I would suggest that whilst it's not easy, and I think we should help them, it would be better if the Syrian refugees took back control of their own country, because it is an awful, awful situation there. And our intervention, whatever intervention we make, must help, not harm. And I thought we should have some questions, Tom, rather than us banging on.
Yeah, that's no problem. Does anyone from the floor want to ask some questions? We'll take that woman up the back.
Thank you very much for your contribution so far. If Britain votes leave, then will Ireland remain stronger? Should we consider an earset if there's a Brexit?
Yeah, there's interesting, very interesting question. The survey evidence shows huge majority in Irish public opinion wanting to stay, even if Britain goes. Remember, in 1975, the Irish government decided that if Britain went out in that referendum, Ireland would stay. That was just a few years later. I tried to emphasise the different political cultures involved. It's not just of scale, the small state and the large state. It's a historical approach to integration, which is very different. That is sustained. It's very interesting to watch the evolution of Sinn Féin's position from what I would call a sovereigntist position, which you might have expected them to be saying in this setting, oh, no, we should actually protect our sovereignty and get out, towards a critical European position where they say, no, it's not a well-organised European integration system, but we're much better off staying in and fighting for one, a more just one, whatever way they put it, which is a real shift, a very interesting shift. But there are some interesting voices. There are some on the left who say we're better off to let Britain go because we'll get a better social Europe out of it. There are some in the IBEC, for example, Danny McCoy has been saying, look, if Britain gets out, they're going to have huge competitive advantages, and we, that so much of the Irish economy relates to Britain that we have to review at the very least our relationship. And there'll be some voices also with Fine Gael saying this. So far, they're rather small, but I think you've touched a real issue there. That's going to open up as a debate if Brexit happens, no matter which model of Brian's, you know, is adopted. So watch this space.
Have we another question from the floor? That gentleman on the right there.
Thank you to all the panellists, especially to Lord Robertson for having the bravery to stand up and
you know. I was a Conservative in the 1997 Parliament, let me tell you.
Fair enough. the question that I want to ask you is simply, aren't you seriously underestimating the impact of a Leave vote of Brexit, given that, I mean, for example, you know, within your party, Prime Minister David Cameron negotiated very, very strongly for London to have one of the principal divisions of the new EU Unified Patent Court. That will allow British businesses to have access to a patent that will cover 25 member states of the EU, potentially be very valuable. Britain will have to leave that court that, you know, was very carefully negotiated over many years if Britain leaves the EU. And the issue of where Scotland will go post-Brexit is very much up in the air. As you know, our other panellists mentioned, that will have a knock-on effect, whether we like it or not, on politics within the rest of the UK, including Northern Ireland. So even if we accept, you know, your argument that, you know, the combined views of Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson and George Galloway ought to be followed and we should leave the EU and the UK, even if we take that view, aren't you underestimating the costs of that decision?
Well, sir, until your last couple of sentences, you made a pretty good case. So I'd just like to ask you whether you think that you are better off being with, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell and Tim Farron and a lot of bad people on both sides. There are a lot of bad people on both sides. I have pursued George Galloway for years. Sorry? Indeed. I am a great fan of David Cameron. I genuinely am. I was very instrumental in his leadership campaign, if I can put it that way. And I think he's the best Prime Minister on the horizon. So I don't want him to resign. I rather regret that he has gone into this with such passion, when I think he should have done a bit of a Wilson. So this is what I got. I would think he should stay and I would stand back. But that is for him. I do think, actually, that you underestimate the way that people will come together. And, of course, there'll be soreness. But I was talking to a Conservative member of the House of Commons yesterday who said, actually, no, we've all sorted out, we will come back together, because we have to. So I'd say that. On your patent court point, I think that's a very good point. I have to say I know very little about patent courts, so there may be others that know more. And your second point, I disagreed with. What was that one? I can't remember now. I didn't write it down. It is true that we may face some really big problems. Of course it is. I don't say it'll all be sweetness and light if we leave the EU. There'll be problems. Of course there'll be problems, bound to be. But there are problems anyway. And my question to you, sir, assuming you're not going to go along with Mr. McDonnell and Uncle Tom Cobbley and all, while I go along with George Galloway, my question to you would be, what do you think the EU will look like in 10 years' time? Because I don't see any reform coming down the track at all.
I think, is there going to be a response from the floor? Yeah, I didn't expect a follow-up question.
Somebody else will answer it, don't worry.
To be honest with you, I think that the EU will probably look much the same as it does now, which is that there are essentially two tiers. You have the Eurozone and you have the periphery. The UK is quite happy and is... It's very advantageous for the UK to be out of the EU while still retaining the benefits, still having a say within other parts of the EU. The crisis in the Mediterranean, in Syria and Iraq and other places, is something that can only be resolved through a collective solution. The UK is going to have to be a part of that, whether it leaves or not. It sees itself as a liberal human rights player within the UN and in the globe more generally, so it will have an interest there. I think that that there certainly is no evidence that there will be this great grand collapse. So that would be my response.
And do you want to come in?
Yeah. We may have a convergence here. The rational basis for the British concern about the deepening integration is the Eurozone, of course. I would agree it has to deepen if it's to survive. I don't think it has to deepen to the extent of the United States of Europe, as I said in my opening remarks. It can be done far short of that. By doing that, it's certainly drawing the lines between those in the Euro and those outside. One has to analyse the Swedes, the Danes and the others who are still outside, whether they are in fact in the same position as the either legally or politically as the UK. And some say they are, some say they are. They aren't. But rules have to be drawn that link that relate to those in the Eurozone and those outside. Further rules have to be drawn if you get a Brexit, those outside outside the EU, and you who do you put in that box? Well, you put Turkey and you put the UK and you put some of those states that may not get accession in the Balkans and elsewhere. You have to draw these lines. So you have a Europe of concentric circles emerging. It's called differentiation or variable geometry by the people who study it. Even if Britain decides to stay in now and the Eurozone deepens thereafter, at a certain point another referendum might be triggered, certainly if there's a treaty change in the UK. So this story is not finished even by this this referendum. Therefore, it's in all our interests to try and draw these lines as rationally as we can. I'd much prefer that they're drawn without a Brexit, but and that you have Britain within the tent, if you like, as a constructive player.
Do you want to come in, Brian, or will I go to another question from the floor?
I'm happy. I'll make my points to the end.
This gentleman here at the back.
We've heard an assumption that Britain will, if Britain leaves the EU, the EU will continue. What would happen afterwards? How confident do you feel, the three of you on the panel, that if Britain, being one of the four corners of the EU economy, with France, with Germany, with Italy, you take one of those four pillars away, the other economies, which are relatively and qualitatively smaller, will continue in a harmonious state?
Well, this is obviously a matter for the good people of the Republic of Ireland, not for me. I would say that, and I do know my Irish history, probably not as well as most of you, but I do know my Irish history. We've had a rather tangled relationship, but certainly when I was a minister in Northern Ireland only a few years ago, I think our relationship had developed to a very good way. And actually, part of that is because we were partners in the EU. I accept that. But I have to say, if I was Irish, I would look at the democratic deficit. I'd look at the Nice Treaty, vote again. I'd look at the Lisbon Treaty, vote again. I'd look at the euro and all the joy that it brought the people of Ireland. And I'd say, well, actually, perhaps I'm being sold a pup on this.
Yeah, I think that, as Paul hinted earlier, the Irish relationship with the EU is not just about pounds, shillings and pence.
If we left. I didn't think that was your argument before, Paul. I thought we were going to be destroyed economically if we left the EU. And the other thing is, somebody suggested
after 2022, if
people like myself
year,
want the EU to collapse.
Was in many respects illusory. There was certainly
if
not a sense of equality.
It would not be to our benefit.
The EU, although it involved a pooling of sovereignty, gave Ireland more power
but it would certainly not be to our benefit.
Enjoyed,
I wish my
and
partners
a truer
and my
neighbours than had previously
on the
been
European
case.
Continent,
and I think everyone in Ireland
whatsoever.
Gets that.
Although we've heard some of them,
that sense of equality that had not really existed prior to EU membership became more real, and not just vis-à-vis the United Kingdom, but vis-à-vis other countries also. And anyone who's worked in the EU institutions and worked with other Irish people sees that very clearly. And that's something which, that lesson, is something which we have tried to communicate to our British friends that. As Obama said, in fact, when he was here, the EU is not some monolith. It's a shell within which nation states seek to vindicate their own interests and find common cause, but ultimately to vindicate their own interests and the interests of their electorates. And Ireland has magnified its power within the EU. Now, there have been, obviously, times when our power disappeared, and the Eurozone crisis was a classic example of that. But there are other times within the common agricultural policy, within other respects, where Ireland magnified its power. And the United Kingdom has, in fact, magnified its power consistently, in my view, certainly since I've been working within the EU, or not within the EU, I've never worked as a civil servant, but certainly participating within the EU, I've seen the UK project and magnify its power because of the strength of its foreign service, because of the alliances that it can build up, particularly with the Germans and the Dutch, and just its skills in negotiation. So, having said that, even if in the short term it is economically disadvantageous for Ireland to remain, I think that ultimately Ireland will stay in, because it's not just about the short-term economic position, it's about long-term development as an independent nation state.
Who'd like to come in there first?
It's a good point. I don't know. As I said, I don't want to see the EU collapse. I fear that it's in really grave trouble. But that's not because of us talking about leaving. It's because of other issues, not least and perhaps most fundamentally economically, is the euro crisis. And I'll just add to that, if we stay, and we are, of course, outside the euro, all this talk of influence, we won't be influencing what all the eurozone does. And I do urge you all, if you don't believe me, to read the five presidents' report published last July, five presidents of the European Commission, all that sort of thing. Although I'm not quite sure why we need five presidents, that's another matter. But read it, because people are telling you what they want to do,
But I have no answer to your question because I just don't know.
So there's no doubt that the EU economically will be weakened if the UK leaves. It's a simple fact. And the EU's influence globally will reduce, and it will be seen as a blow for the EU's geopolitical ambitions, which it has, as Andrew says. Vladimir Putin will be very pleased. But will it break up as a result? I don't think so. And I think one thing that we tend to underestimate, and I say this in Britain and in Ireland, we don't appreciate enough the very powerful political instinct in Germany and France to maintain their integration. And it's not just about the Enarch or the elites. It is something very profound between those Benelux, French and German countries. Whatever happens, to maintain the integration they have secured. And so even if the Eurozone crisis comes back and intensifies, even if the migrant crisis continues and gets worse, and even if the UK leaves, the core EU will remain, for as far as I can see.
I would agree. The crises have been addressed by modelling through and modelling up, and a lot of people find this very unsatisfactory. But I think the instinct politically is there, as you describe. Again, just to repeat, it's not the federalist bogeyman. It's an existential and necessary instinct to create harmonious conditions of interdependence when you're living so closely together and are so bound up together on the continent of Europe. That's going to survive. And Ireland and other, you know, states like Spain and Portugal coming out of democracy, coming into democracy through Europeanisation, have bought into this, and that's a political buy-in, and that's also going to survive. So on balance, if you're weighing up the economic and political effects, I would say also that it may be weakened, but it's more likely to survive than not.
As someone who has the misfortune to live in France and pay French taxes, I agree with Paul's view. But can we imagine, before I give back the microphone...
possession.
Imagine that Ireland's, from a purely selfish point of view... Imagine that Ireland's number one trading partner took the decision to leave the EU. What should Ireland do? Should it follow A, the position of our align ourselves with our major trading partner of today and of the past 100 years? Or should we, as we did back in 78, and this is a question perhaps that Paul can pick up on, the decisions we made in 78, which were partly political and partly economic, distance ourselves from our real economic number one partner, pursuing a certain ideological wish to integrate ourselves with other people?
It's not just an ideological wish. The trade proportion with Britain is 70% now. Now, it's far larger for Irish-owned small and medium industry. It's 45%. But it's far less than it used to be.
It's still number one, though, isn't it?
It's number one, but it's number one. But, I mean, we trade nearly as much with the US as with the UK. We trade nearly as much with Germany as with the UK. So it's actually far more diverse than it used to be. Therefore, it's more sustainable to survive this. Number one point. Number two point. Britain out of Europe becomes a very unstable place. It's more likely than not to break up. It's, in my view, in 10 years' time, it would be actually wanting to get back into the EU much more likely than the EU would be likely to break up. So it would put itself in a mendicant role, rather reminiscent of our mendicant role up to the 1970s, and I'm being provocative there, but that's as plausible a scenario as the breakup.
With equal provocation, Paul, you remember that in 1978 you could travel from Galway on the Atlantic to Great Yarmouth on the North Sea using the same money without showing a passport. So what have we advanced since then?
Well, I think we've much greater continental place to travel around.
Does anyone else in the panel want to respond to that follow or stay question?
Well, not particularly on that, although this is my point. And why on earth would people not be able to travel between Ireland and the United Kingdom? Absurd. If you ask me, I mean, I wouldn't be in favour of putting in travel restrictions, but we would be in favour of putting in perhaps rather more travel restrictions on some people coming from particularly new states, the EU. But look, as I said, I'm rather old. I went on holiday in France long before we joined the EU. I went skiing in Austria. I went, I went on holiday in Germany. I mean, these things are possible if only one has a little bit of faith. An optimism. Of course they're possible. Of course the sky will not fall in if we leave the EU. I think the trend will be different, and I think it will be better for the European Union, actually, if perhaps we could help it reform, although I doubt it will happen, but it might.
What should Ireland do?
I think we've already addressed this question, and I think that certainly my preference and my view would be that Ireland should definitely not leave simply because of short-term economic difficulties that result from Brexit. Gareth Fitzgerald put it best when he said that our development as a nation state and as a society was progressed by the EU, by EU membership, more than by any other factor. That was the key moment in our development as a country and as a society in terms of openness and pluralism and self-confidence. EU membership was fundamental to that. So for Ireland, it's not just about economic development or the common agricultural policy. It's about our sense of self and our sense as a nation. And I know it's difficult sometimes to relate that to countries like Britain or France, where they didn't have the same history and they have a much stronger sense of their national destiny. But for Ireland, that wasn't fully realised until the EU gave us that platform. And that was fundamental to our development. It's not as important now as it was in the 70s, but I think we would make a big mistake if we were to look no further than Great Yarmouth in terms of our future economic development.
We're just coming to the end of this evening, but is there one more question from the floor?
I say there's a lot of doom and gloom about the EU and a lot of people talking about what does the future hold, but maybe you could educate a young fella like myself. What has Britain not gained from being in the EU over the last 30 to 40 years?
Where shall I start? I mean, first of all, it costs us £350 million a week to the EU. Now, I was talking to Brian earlier, and I don't think I'm betraying confidence when he says the waste you see in Brussels is extraordinary. Tell me about the European Parliament. Qui bono? You know, lawyers here, aren't they? I think I know what that means. You know, what's the point? And we get enormous numbers of directives and rules passed down which we have to abide by. Since you're a young person, let me tell you something which my neighbour in Leicestershire said the other day. Nicky Morgan, she's the Education Secretary, you may know. She said, if we were to vote to leave, and I like Nicky, if we were to vote to leave, first of all, you wouldn't be able to go into railing. And my wife said, that's funny, I went into railing before we joined the EU. And the second thing is that there would be a lost generation of young people. All I would say is go and tell that to the young people in Spain, where they have 45% youth unemployment, or the young people in Italy, or the young people in Greece. I mean, look, I can't tell you everything's going to be perfect, and I don't believe it will be, but I do think that we should take back control. And actually, I might just pick up, Paul said that Scotland may leave the Union. They voted only 18 months ago by 55% to 45% to remain. It could be the case, of course. Don't predict, because nobody knows what will happen, but I do know we'd be better off if we left the EU, if only by that £350 million a day, which we could spend on things we'd spend on ourselves. A week, sorry, thank you. Exaggeration, hyperbole, it's a bit of a problem with politicians, you know that.
I'd just make one comment on it, and I detected a Northern Ireland voice in the question. Some of the arguments that I've heard Arlene Foster indeed say at a meeting in Belfast, that the money that was saved from getting out of the EU would continue to be transferred to Belfast to the extent that it now is, the transfer from London, which is the biggest transfer to any region of the the UK. And the hall gasped in not only in surprise but in disbelief. I think to say that is to be very naive about the dynamics amongst those who would claim the victory politically in the UK. They would be much less willing to subsidise a periphery such as the north of Ireland, it seems to me, and that actually would be a factor in the disenchantment of Scotland and of Northern Ireland and of Wales in the likely victory. But that's just my interpretation. I may be wrong. I grant you, I think it's more likely than not that I'm right.
just to answer the particular question, which is what has not worked out well for the UK in terms of relationship. And it's interesting to contrast the UK's position with, say, Spain or Greece. Because if we were in Spain or Greece now, it would be a harder sell. But for the United Kingdom, that country has secured a very favourable package. And has projected its influence within the council. Federica Mogherini was mentioned earlier on, and it's true, no one elected her. But she has become a tool, a very important tool, of British foreign policy, in particular in relation to Iran and Russia. The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran and Russia in particular, which the UK could not have achieved by itself, certainly would not have been as pervasive and as effective by the UK unilaterally. And those have been imposed at the prompting of the United Kingdom, and in the face of opposition from other member states, but they have been imposed and successfully, primarily because of UK influence and UK alliance building within the EU. The second point is, in terms of UK success in the Council of Ministers, a reference was made earlier, I think, by my friend, to 72 defeats in the Council of Ministers. Well, you will know immediately that figure is, with respect, misleading. The Council of Ministers votes on thousands of measures. And between 2009 and 2011, 90.7% of all Council of Ministers' measures were supported by the United Kingdom. Over 90% were supported by the United Kingdom. And for a part of that period, obviously, by a Eurosceptic, although you may doubt in the degree of Euroscepticism, Conservative administration, or at least a coalition. So the United Kingdom has been uniquely successful within the European Union. And that's why this whole debate is quite bizarre. In a way, as Irish people, we maybe have an insight because, if you think about it, especially the year that's in it, 1916, in 1916, the case was put to poor Pearson and others that it was lunacy to leave the Union because at that stage the United Kingdom was one of the richest countries in the world, certainly had the biggest empire in the world, and, truth be told, the average Irish person wasn't doing too badly out of it. The peasantry had achieved land ownership to a large degree. There was urban poverty, but that wasn't necessarily the direct fault of Westminster rule. So the economic case for independence was not as strong in 1916, for example, as it might have been earlier. But the point that they made was, the leaders among 1916 and the Sinn Féin campaign in 1918, was that it's not about money. It's about securing genuine power over your own destiny. And it seems to me that a lot of the convincing Eurosceptic debate is that it's not about the economic dislocation and the economic difficulties that will follow. It is better to suffer economically, but to retain control of your own destiny. And Nigel Farage, in a rare moment of honesty, said he would pay the price of a certain degree of economic decline in order to reduce migration. And that had the benefit, at least, of clarity and honesty. And I think the difficulty with the debate is that both sides are not being entirely honest. Both sides are exaggerating. But for me, the most convincing Eurosceptic argument is the one that we are prepared to pay the price. We are prepared to take the economic dislocation and be poorer, potentially for a long time, as indeed Ireland was after 1922. But that's worth it for the power that we will restore to our own parliament. Unfortunately, my own view is that in an interdependent world, that power would be illusory. And that's why I maintain the position that I set out at the beginning.
As I said, I don't think I should tell you. My own view is that you can remain in a close relationship with us whether you stay or whether you leave, and I suspect you would wish to stay. Although, unlike Tom, I wouldn't, or Paul, I wouldn't make any presumptions about the good British, as good Irish, voting public, because people can be quite fickle, and I would let them vote once and accept their view rather than on the Nice and Lisbon Treaty as happened.
May I just come back briefly?
I mean, I said it may be that we suffer economically. I mean, who knows? Nobody knows. And it may be we suffer economically if we remain in the European Union. I'm not a great fan of Nigel Farage or George Galloway. But, you know, nobody knows. I mean, this nonsensical report the Treasury brought out, which said that by 2030, every household will be £4,300 or something worse off. I mean, this is just... Looking at the ladies in the audience, I won't say what I think of it, but it's just nonsense. Absolute nonsense. They have no idea. The Treasury got their forecast wrong in November for this year. So they just have no idea. Now, things may suffer. Of course they may. And things may suffer if we stay in the EU. But I still think that, and there is some validity in what you say, that we would have political control. We would have control over what we wanted to have. And it's not to do with people from Romania taking benefits, although that happens. It's not to do with that. It's to do with actually whether the good people of the electorate of the United Kingdom can determine what happens to their country, or whether they so lack confidence, they're so unoptimistic, they think an unelected bunch in Brussels should tell us what to do. And they're probably most of them quite nice. I'd rather that people were able to vote for politicians here who decided what should happen to the people of the United Kingdom rather than people in Brussels.
Thank you. Just before we conclude, guys, could we have a show of hands for the stay side of things? Remain. And how many people think that who would vote for Brexit?
Looks like I've won.
Anyway, look, I'd like to thank you all for coming this evening, and if we could all give our panel a round of applause.
You have been listening to a podcast by the London Irish Business Society. We would especially like to thank our sponsors, Morgan McKinley and Enterprise Ireland, for their ongoing support. You can read more about the Society, its events, and join for free membership at www.li-bs.co.uk.